It's the Full 48. Howard Beck, senior NBA writer for Bleacher Report. The Milwaukee Bucks are gone. Congrats, folks. We now get, let's say, 6 to 12 months of nonstop Giannis rumors. That'll be fun. But that's not all. There's a new coach in Brooklyn. Usual drama in Philly. Possible rebuild in OKC. Maybe a Chris Paul trade. It's never too soon to talk about the offseason in the NBA. And here to help me break all that down and answer some burning questions is the Hate Hard King, the famed inventor of the Patino game, my friend Amin El Hassan of ESPN. Amin, what's happening?
What's going on, Beck?
Things are good, man. I always love when we can simultaneously discuss really great playoff series and nonstop offseason drama that has yet to begin. That's like the sweet spot for NBA punditry, I think.
No, that's you pretty much described NBA punditry. It's like, who's going to win and who's leaving next? That's what we do.
It is.
We're really good at that.
We don't even have to wait till after the game. We could be like the third quarter. It'll be like, wow, this is a really great game. Hey, where's Giannis going to be?
Yeah.
Like, I'm already getting texts from friends who are like tangentially in the business who are already asking about my predictions, like, where's Giannis going to be in 2022? Which is actually, credit to that person, because they're actually giving some thought to the idea that, hey, you know what, maybe he chills out for a bit here and actually plays out the string. It's actually giving benefit of the doubt to the idea that Giannis is not going to immediately bolt. But we'll get to that in a second. So it's the playoffs. I've only had you on the one time. That was earlier this year. So it was not the playoffs. This is the first time I've had you on in the midst of the heat of Patino game. What was the best and worst Patino game entries you got last night with the Bucks out?
Ooh, the best one I got would have been, oh, that's a good question. You gave me all this prep work.
And then I didn't tell you that one.
Yeah, this one's a lot harder. I would say Paul McKeskey.
Can never go wrong with Paul McKeskey.
Or Dan Gadzirich was a good one as well.
I saw Joe Alexander. Joe Alexander's a good one.
Yeah. Joe Alexander is a good one, but it was a plentiful one. Like, to me, the best ones are always the ones that don't get a lot of play, right? So if you ask me what the worst ones are, it's either the ones where the guy never played for the Bucks, so I'm not even going to dignify those responses, or the really obvious ones. If you say Kareem or Oscar, like, you're really not stretching yourself at all with this. I want Todd Day to not walk through that door, right? Or Lee Mayberry, or names like that.
I wonder what percentage of like a team's players you might get in a given night of Patino game. Like, are they creative enough to have gone like through the entire catalog of like the last 10 years? Like, because it's a high percent. There's a very good variety there for all the, you know, mass amounts of like Jabari Parkers you probably got or Michael Redds you probably got. You got your Paul McKeskeys. So, you know, credit to people for getting, you know, somewhat creative.
Bucks was a good one. Blazers was the best one so far. People really came very diverse with it. Some of these other ones, Thunder was probably the worst we've ever had it. Where like I announced several times over several days, Sonics are not eligible. And then the first thing everyone does is say, Vin Baker's not walking. I'm like, gosh, I said Sonics aren't eligible. So, that's my gift to the city of Seattle. I will not desecrate their memory by letting their vaunted players be mentioned in a Thunder Patino game situation.
I respect that. Shout out to the Metropolitan Grill. Missed that place.
We all do, Beth. We all do.
All right. So listen, I've got burning questions, as I sometimes have on this podcast. We got to hit some of these teams. We have to, of course, we're morally obligated, legally obligated to start with the Bucks, because the questions about Giannis have been going on for a while. I was writing about this 2 years ago in more of a constructive, I think, nuanced way of just like, this is inevitable because this is today's NBA. And that was at the time that Anthony Davis was about to agitate to get out. Giannis last night tells Chris Haynes of Yahoo Sports, it's not happening, meaning a trade demand. That's not happening. This is his quote. Some see a wall go in another direction. I plow through it. We have to get better as a team individually and get right back at it next season. All right, so that's great. That's exactly what you want to hear if you're a Bucks fan or Bucks ownership, Bucks GM, John Horst. That's what you want to hear. And that's consistent with what we've known of Giannis as a guy who is kind of defiant and wants to do it his own way and has a loyalty streak in him. All that said, I mean, you and I have both been around this league a long time. Nothing means anything. Everybody can change their minds and people can leave. And even if he doesn't demand a trade, He can wait a little while and simply softly request a trade, or he could just suggest it in a way that lets them know that I'm not signing the max, the supermax, and maybe you should put wheels in motion. What do you think of his response? Where do you think this is ultimately going, given the wall that they have absolutely smashed into?
All right. So as far as the response goes, I likened it to in the NCAA tournament. You got a kid, a freshman phenom, supposed to be like a lottery pick, and then they lose in the first round or in the second round. And they go and they ask him immediately, what are you going to do next year? And the kid inevitably always says, everyone's coming back and we're going to win a national championship next year. And 3 weeks later, what does he do? He declares for the draft. Because it's not fair to ask someone in the throes of defeat, what are you going to do with your life? That's just a...
It's what we do.
Not where, but it's not where their mind is at. Yeah. So the savvy player will answer the way Giannis answered. Because I say in this situation, there are two things players do not owe us. They don't owe us honesty, and they don't owe us consistency. Meaning, if you're planning on leaving, you don't have to tell us the truth. You can lie and say, I want to stay here. I want to work it out. If you're not planning on leaving, you don't have to be beholden to this answer for all time immemorium, right? Like, I have to. I said it to Chris Haynes right after the game. I can't change my mind. I'm a man of my word. No, that's not how any of this works.
No.
You do whatever you want, especially when you've had the opportunity to sit back and think about it. As far as what he's actually going to do, this is what I would say. I would say that most of the time when we talk about these great players leaving the franchise, it's usually due to the ineptitude of the franchise. Anthony Davis is a shining example of this. I gave you seven of the best years of my life, and you guys didn't have your bleep together. Can I curse?
They got him. Yes, you can bleep to your heart's content. Okay. F-bomb right. Away. But they did get him Omer Asik, so.
Yeah, exactly, right? Like this is what I had to deal with. I had to deal with incompetent management. And I happened to deal with an ownership group that treated me as an oversight, that treated my organization as an oversight. You know, we don't have to sugarcoat it.
Yeah.
They're second-class citizens. Forget about New Orleans. In the Benson family, they're second-class citizens. So Anthony Davis doesn't owe anything to wait for you to get your shit together, right? Like Kevin Garnett did. He waited for 12 years for them to get their shit together in Minnesota. Giannis is not in that situation. He plays for a very well-run organization that has a great ownership group.
Agreed.
Are they perfect? Have they made mistakes? Yes. Nobody's perfect. They all make mistakes, and mistakes that have, I would say, limited his success these last 2 years. But where were they 3 years ago? Where were they 4 years ago? It's not like he's been banging his head against the wall with no results. They've improved steadily, you know, throughout this tenure. And so for all those things, I say, probably not in a rush to leave at this point.
Yeah, I agree with that. But I see this two ways. And let me pick up on something that Giannis, I think, also got to at one point in that interview with Chris Haynes, and that he's discussed before, too. Giannis has a really endearing and I think very truthful and real humility to him. And so to the extent that their failure in this postseason was partially his failure and his limitations as a player, despite being likely two-time MVP, almost certainly two-time. He has his limitations. And I think he's the kind of player who his first thought is going to be, I gotta be better. I gotta develop a mid-range game. I gotta work on these other things before he necessarily starts pointing at teammates who failed him. But I also think in this league, and when you're a superstar, it is completely fair to look at the roster around you and where the failings may be of management getting the right guys or those guys performing when it matters most. And Bucks fans have hated it when I've said this every time for the last couple of years, but he doesn't have that true number two. Chris Middleton is a really, really good player and an all-star. He's not a true number two that we're used to seeing. And just real quick, I mean, let me just go through. So last year, all right, Kawhi wins with not a true number two, unless it's Lowry, it's Siakam. It was more of an ensemble, I think, for the Raptors. But those guys are both really good, and they're all-stars. And it is three all-stars on that team. 2018, the second-best player was Steph Curry. I'm going through championship teams, by the way. 2017, the second-best player was Steph Curry. Again, now the Warriors fans are going to be mad at me because I said Kevin Durant was better. But he was the MVP of those finals. 2016, the second-best player on the championship team was Kyrie Irving. The year before that, the second best player was take your pick, Klay Thompson, Draymond Green. 2014, Tim Duncan or Tony Parker, take your pick as supporting Kawhi. 2013 and 2012, the second best player on the championship team was Dwayne freaking Wade. And so you go all the way back to 2011, and it's like, all right, Dirk had, you know, Tyson Chandler, Jason Kidd, but it's an old Jason Kidd, Sean Marion. Ensemble cast again there. And then, of course, 2008, the second best player was, oh, I don't know, Kevin Garnett, Ray Allen, take your pick. Like, this is how it usually goes. I skipped over the Pau Gasol, Lamar Laker. Odom, Lakers. Chris Middleton is none of those people. I'm sorry. He's not. And that, like, I do think that matters, Amin. And I'm not saying that that's why Giannis should ask out or will or anything else. But I am saying that if championship is the goal, and it is, and if the championship, this is, I know this is reductive and all that, but like, you need another superstar usually in this league most of the time, or two other all-stars, not one Chris Middleton. And I don't know where the Bucks go from here to solve that.
This is where I'm going to push back on you.
Go for it.
First of all, or before I get into pushing back on Chris Middleton, I'll say this. Everything that we said about Giannis and his desire for self-improvement and internal locus of control and all those things, right? That can all apply and say he's not going to request a trade, but it doesn't necessarily mean he's going to sign an extension.
Agreed.
And that's the tricky part, right? The tricky part isn't Giannis said he's not going to leave and then tomorrow he's going to tell John Horst, I want to trade. The tricky part is he's going to say all the things because he believes it and he's going to go through the season and he might, like your buddy presciently asked, he might sign like a 2-year deal, a 1+1, right?
But
then the idea is at some point he's going to also retain the flexibility to say at some point it doesn't get done, I'm going to leave myself the opportunity to go somewhere else and pursue it somewhere else. And that's what puts the Bucks in an uncomfortable situation. When it comes to Chris Middleton, so we did this thing on The Jump today called Blame Pie. It's a recurring bit we do whenever something awful happens and we try to figure out whose fault is it, right? And so I split it up four ways. I gave the biggest slice to Bud, and then the second biggest slice to Giannis, then the third biggest slice to Chris Middleton and company, and then the smallest slice was to management, to the Bucks management and ownership. And what I mean by that is, you know, just like a cliff notes, they let go of Brogdon. They try to be cute. I get it. 3 years from now, that deal's going to look bad, but your window is now. Your window isn't 3 years from now.
Totally.
That's
agree.
Why I blame them.
Yeah.
I blame Giannis because obviously he can be a better shooter, but as you pointed out earlier, he can be specifically better in the mid-range. Floaters and runners and things that I do when I can't get to the rim to make me a more devastating player. And then obviously Bud putting Giannis in a position to be successful other than give him a ball at the top and let him rip, right?
Right.
Whether it's him off ball or getting other people more involved, as we saw in the last two games of that series after Giannis was out, Bud could do so much more. There's a lot more Bud could do. But when I focus on the Chris Middleton part, this is what I say. Chris Middleton is an all-star, and he is an all-NBA player. Is he Dwayne Wade? Is he Steph Curry? No, he's not. But I think he's good enough to be a number two if Giannis is the number one on this team. They're good enough to win a championship talent-wise. But it's going to take Chris Middleton to have very real conversations with Bud. You got to use me better. The way you use me, it's very hard for me to be anything greater than what I am, right? It's like Dwayne Wade that first year in Miami. If I'm going to be used in this way, stand there in the corner and just wait, I'm not going to be very good at this. So I think Bud's got to be more creative in the way he uses Chris Middleton. Chris Middleton has to have a strong conversation with his teammates. Sometimes, I know Giannis is awesome. You got to bark at him, get me the fucking ball. Because it's not because I'm better at this than you are, but because in order for you to be the best that you can be, I have to be a real threat, not a stand in the corner and wait till I get you the ball so I can shoot threat, right? And then third, he has to have a very tough conversation with himself. What can I do to be more aggressive and make more of an impact on the game? Because as a 20-plus point per game scorer on 50-40-90 splits, who's also an excellent, versatile defensive player, there's no way he should be having these type of playoff performances. So I don't think the Bucks are far off. I think the Heat were the worst possible matchup they could have had. I called it in March or February, whatever. That they've just, it's just a bad matchup. But also, I think they have the requisite talent. They need a couple things here and there. They need tweaks like everybody does. But I don't think they're far off from a championship.
So to the idea that they can win with Chris Middleton as the number two, I agree if there's also a number three. In other words, like, right, they need co-number twos. Like, you need, if your number two is Chris Middleton, and again, like, this is not meant to slight him, but if your number two is Chris Middleton instead of, say, Dwayne Wade or Steph Curry or Kobe Bryant or any number of other, like, super-duper stars who have been, you know, who have had another super-duper star next to him, then you need a third All-Star usually, or somebody who flirts with All-Star status, and there's nobody else on that roster. Like, you do need somebody else, and they need playmakers, and they lost right. that with Brogdon when they decided not to re-sign him. I thought that was a mistake at the time. I think it's a mistake now. I don't know if Brogdon would have changed this series or not. Nobody can tell us that. But I do agree with you, Amin, that they, at a minimum, you keep him because you have a window. You need to do everything possible to show that Giannis that you will spare no expense. And in fact, they spared an expense. They decided right. not to keep him. And even if it was worrying about his knees and what comes down the line, in the near term, you have to say, fuck it. We'll spend the money to try to win now. Because
you do it because the window's open now.
And don't give Giannis any reason to believe that you're not fully committed.
Right. And to that point, to that end, I recall the story. I tell this a lot, but it's a good one. Like, Mike D'Antoni talking about golfing with Dan Marino. And Dan Marino was like, we went to the Super Bowl, it was second or third year in the league, and we lost, and we're disappointed, but there's a part of you like, we'll get him next year. And he never went back to the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
And so, and Mike tells the story, you know, to illustrate and punctuate, guys, don't take any of this for granted, right? Like, Oklahoma City was supposed to go to 15 million finals in a row, right? And be this crazy dynasty. And literally, it didn't even last an offseason before it broke up.
Yeah.
You never know. So when that window's open, you got to kick it open all the way and come guns blazing, because this might be your last chance. And sometimes there are decisions that you can make that you know for a fact, 3 years from now, I'm going to be kicking myself. This is going to be a tough one to swallow. But you don't worry about it then if the window is now. I'm not talking about you're a second-round team and you think, oh, yeah, if we pay Antonio Davis and Jerome Williams and Alvin Williams, this will be great. Like, I'm not talking about like that. I'm talking about we are on the cusp of title. We have the MVP. We have the best record in the league. We're, you know, our net rating is amazing. That's not the time where you're like, well, is there a way we can kind of like you do it.
Yeah.
You do it because this might be your only opportunity. It's the same thing what happened with the Warriors. Now, thankfully, I guess luckily for them, they never came face to face with it. But we were at a point 2 years ago or a year ago, we were talking about, holy shit, they might be looking at a repeater tax that the size of which we've never seen before. And I said, you do it. You do it because you win as many as you can and then worry about all that shit for the next decade. You do it 100 times. I live in Phoenix, Arizona. Jerry Colangelo did absolute the worst financing job with the Diamondbacks. But guess what? They have that World Series.
Yeah.
And people remember it fondly, and nobody talks about how Jerry Colangelo screwed up the books, because he screwed up the books with a purpose. The window is now. Let's go get it.
Yeah. You want to hear my hottest take on the Bucks? Here's my burning hot take. They're not a failure. They're not a disappointment. They're a victim of their own success because they overachieved. Like, this team on paper, solid, fine, but miles ahead of everybody. It's why I always had doubts about them, because the record indicated that they were laps ahead of the field in the East, and I didn't think they were, and they weren't. And this is not to pat myself on the back. I just think Bud got absolutely the most possible out of them in the regular season, and maybe not enough in the postseason. But I think they raised expectations partially because Giannis is a back-to-back MVP, and that just comes with it. But I also think, like, when you evaluate the whole picture, this is a team that raised expectations to an almost unreasonable level in terms of this season's endpoint, because their record and their net rating and all the advanced stats made them look, I think, better than they actually had a right to be based on the actual talent on the roster.
Yeah, I went on Ethan's podcast and I explained this to people. This is how it goes, right? Your net rating, your offensive rating for the season, your defensive rating for the season, they are prereqs. They are not guarantees. Ethan said it's not a down payment on a house.
Yeah, well put.
Right?
Yeah.
It's just your credit rating, right? So if your credit rating is 300, you're not going to be eligible to buy this house, right? But if your credit rating is 800, you're eligible. It still doesn't mean you're going to buy the house, right? It just means you're eligible. So in the same way, people have learned to glorify those numbers because we told them in order to win a championship, the last 30 champions or whatever have been top 10 in offense and defense with like a couple exceptions, I believe, 2016 Cavs and 2001 Lakers, right? But for the most part, these are both top 10 and top 10 offenses and defenses, right? But that in and of itself doesn't mean anything. It just means that you can't be trash and win a championship. But once you get to the nitty gritty, your offensive and defensive ratings are built upon A, beating up on terrible teams, as you should, right? And B, beating up on even good teams that caught you on a back-to-back, or even, forget a back-to-back, caught you with 24 to 48 hours worth of time to prep for you with one assistant coach, one video coordinator, an advanced scout, you know, prepping your prior five games and your players introduced to the concepts like the day of, the morning of, we're going to play you. That doesn't mean shit when we get to a seven-game series when the entire staff, everybody's just focused on you. And we're watching hours and hours of film, and the players are watching hours and hours of film, and everybody's sitting around. There was a quote from Bam Adebayo earlier. I want to say, I don't even know if it was this series or last series, but he had a great game, and they said, how'd you have this great game? And he said, Udonis Haslam pointed out all of these weak spots. I think it was in the Bucks series. And I just basically attacked all those weak spots. You don't get that in a regular season. Udonis Haslam's not sitting around watching weeks worth of Bucks games to tell Bam for a February date, hey, by the way, they're really susceptible here. Because you don't have time. We're worried about next opponent. And we'll keep moving on. And so all of these regular season accolades, while nice, they don't mean much if you're not going to make adjustments. And that's why I throw it back on Bud. Right, you said Bud got the most out of him in the regular season. You're right. But Bud has this stubbornness that I think holds him back. And that's where he needs to get better, to realize adjustments isn't an acknowledgement of a flaw in your plans. It's just an acknowledgement that the opponent is changing and is adapting to what you're doing. They're smart, too. They've got good players, too. So you've got to figure out how to get them out of their comfort zone that they've found.
So here's the part where I give my usual disclaimer about the Bucks and Giannis whenever this discussion comes up. No matter how much I talk about it or speculate on it, folks, I actually want him to stay. I've been very consistent about this over the years. I think for the NBA, don't do that. It's this small market tick that everybody has, that fans have, and they all feel persecuted. And I get it. I understand why all their stars keep fucking leaving. I don't think it's good for the league on balance. I think that if small markets become essentially farm teams for glamour markets, not just big markets, but glamour markets like Miami, which is actually mid-market, but it's a destination. If it's just a farm system that undercuts fan belief, fan faith, fan loyalty, it undermines the whole league, and it makes it feel like you're on the clock. The moment you get a star on your roster through the draft, and if you can't figure it out in 5 to 7 years, he's gone, and they go win championships somewhere else, and you're left with, you know, dust. I don't think it's healthy for the league on balance. I would rather see Giannis stay. I hope he does. You know, I hate to say buck the trend, but we know what the history of the last 10 years is with
the stars.
Can I push
back on that?
You think it's healthy for the?
Can I push back on that?
Oh God, I didn't even expect this to be a tangent. Okay, go.
Yeah, it's healthy because it forces organizations to have good management.
Okay, yes.
If you are trash, you don't deserve to keep these guys.
And the Bucks are not trash, as you and I would agree.
The Bucks are not trash.
Good ownership, good front office, and yes, they have made their mistakes, including Brogdon. This would be a terrible, terrible example of how you're screwed in a small market if he does leave, because this is not the Pelicans or previously the Hornets and Chris Paul. Like, this is not. And, you know, look, some guys have left even despite success. Like, Carmelo forced his way out of Denver, you know, like, shortly after he made the conference finals. Like, you know, LeBron left, you know, Cleveland after, what, a 65-win season?
66 and 61, I think, were the two last seasons. But again, that wasn't a good organization.
No, bad organization and no true second star there either, by the way, and I'll be consistent on that too. Like, when owner, if a superstar doesn't see a path to getting another star next to him that is required in this league to win a championship, I'm all in favor of them exercising their right to leave. I just think, while I do believe in that, I also believe it's not great for the league on the whole and for its smaller markets. And you're right. I mean, like, it should keep the pressure on smaller market teams, especially to be that much better, and to manage themselves better, to be smarter about the way that they manage their resources, their cap, all of that. But I also just think that this movement in the last 10 years undermines the idea that this is a 30-team league where presumably you all have a reasonable chance to compete. I hope he stays. I'm not convinced he will.
I do too. I think the margin of error is smaller when you're in a small market. That is true. But I do think, again, if that were the case, the Knicks would be swimming in free agents.
Right.
And the reality is, step one isn't be in a big market. Step one is have a clue.
Yes.
Act like you have a clue. Act like you have your shit together. And so all the places that complain, I always feel like they've got something in common. Your people don't have their shit together, right? Like, you have no right to be upset that you know, some of these guys leave. Now, again, Milwaukee's not one of those places. Milwaukee is one that I would say, by and large, is a good example of a well-run organization. But at the same time, I look at, like I said, the Brogdon thing was a problem. And the other problem is, yo, bud, you're not perfect. You are always on the clock. We are all on the clock.
Yes.
That's the nature of this game. Because these superstars are that talented, even Miami, if we're going to call it, even though it's not a big market, Miami, that was this powerhouse, they were on the clock, and eventually the clock ran out on them.
Yeah.
It comes for us all. Golden State, they built a shining the dynasty. They were on the clock with Durant, and that clock ran out. Now, their clock ran out. They did nothing wrong other than deliver everything they promised him. He was looking ultimately for something else. But the reality is, regardless of who you are, big market, small market, you have to keep these guys happy if you want to keep them. That is a universal. That is not a small market, big market thing. That is a universal affliction.
It's actually your number one requirement as an owner and GM if you're fortunate enough to have a superstar on your team. Keep them happy. All right, last thing on this before we move on from the Bucks. So Giannis is eligible for like a $221 million Supermax as soon as the offseason starts, whenever the hell that's going to be. There's all kinds of reasons that he could and probably will decline it, because he's going to be rich beyond belief regardless. He already is rich beyond belief regardless. This is one of the problems with the modern NBA, is that the money is so ridiculous now that guys can leave 50, 60 million on the table and still be wealthy beyond their wildest dreams. That's not a problem. It's great for the players, but it undermines the previous concepts that kept players from fleeing all the time. So I won't be surprised if he turns down the Supermax. It won't necessarily mean that he wants to leave. It may just be that he wants to keep them, put the pressure on, and see where they go next season, see if they can have the breakthrough. And if they don't, then he can walk away in free agency. If they do break, I mean, he'll make his whatever decisions. But if he turns down the Supermax, I mean, if you're John Horst, if you're the owners, Lazarus and Edens, how do you navigate that? Do you trade him because we're afraid of losing him for nothing? Do you trade him before next season? Do you trade him before the trade deadline? Do you play it out and say, F it, we're just going to try to win a championship, and if he walks, he walks, but we're keeping him till the very last possible minute?
Yeah, I think, first of all, you know, you have to trust and keep those lines of communication open with him and his representation. You got to say, look, if you guys feel like this thing is going south, let us know, and we'll make the adjustments, right? Like, we'll accommodate. But it's got to be truthful. I don't think you can pull the ripcord before he gives you any reason to pull said ripcord. I think, obviously, they have improvements that they have to do. If their plan is, we're just going to come back and try it all over again, then you might as well trade them, because that ain't going to get it done. That's not going to get it done. But if you say, look, we're going to go out and get another playmaker, you know, whether that's Chris Paul or someone else, that remains to be seen. And, you know, we're going to revamp our playbook. We're going to make it more motion based, more kind of egalitarian, give more of an onus on Middleton to create. And then finally, like, obviously we see Giannis in the gym. How is he doing progressing on these things? You're going to know if you're making the necessary improvements that are reasonable given the resources they have to them. If, again, if you're not making those improvements, then I think at that point you have to have a conversation about moving him prior to him asking to move, what I call the Deron Williams, right? Deron Williams didn't ask out of Utah. But Utah looked at like 1 + 1 + 1 + 1 + 1. Yeah. And if you add all this up, he's going to be gone in 2 years. So if we move now, we've got an opportunity to get great value on him.
Yeah. Much more difficult, painful to come to that conclusion when the player in question is Giannis and not Deron Williams. But yeah. And that's what the communication thing is, as you say. Like, and I think that they've got a good relationship between that organization and his representation. I think that will be the case. So yeah, he can say right now, I don't want out, but at some point he may, and as long as he conveys that to them, they'll have that chance. But it's such a tough spot to be in, though. Like, there's no the you know, trade a guy with a year left on his deal and try to get like, you know, a boatload of assets, great, but you're still gonna be years away from being back to this level, because that's almost always how it goes. Keep him too long, he walks for nothing. Yeah, try to do a sign and trade, you'll get less in a sign and trade. There's no, if he decides he wants out, there really is no great outcome for them.
But by the way, this goes back to quote Princess Leia, the more you tighten your grip, the more systems slip through your fingers, right?
Yes, sir.
A lot.
I love that we got
issues,
to a Star Wars reference. I love it.
A lot of the issues of why these teams are losing star players and getting cratered afterwards is because they fought tooth and nail against sign and trades, where I can get all of the benefits and get traded to a new team, like LeBron, Bosch, and Bosch did, right? If that had still remained, you could gleefully hold on to Giannis throughout the end of his contract, and then he says, I want to leave. Like, oh, thanks for the memories. Let's work out the sign and trade so you get more money and I get some stuff. Because
yeah.
No player, given the option of going to a certain location and getting more money, is going to say, no, I really want that first-round pick to stay. They don't care. They're like, whoa. I can get all the money and still go to the city I want to go to? It was the perfect system that kept everybody happy. They cut off their noses to spite their faces, and now they're wondering why they're gushing blood out of this hole on their face.
It's a lovely visual. I won't go down the CBA rabbit hole of how they screw themselves with the usual, we're going to clamp down on something that seems to benefit the players and then have the unintended consequences. But yes, they fucked up the sign and trade several years ago. I think that was the 2011 lockout. But they did screw it up, and we don't need to go down that rabbit hole any further. All right, moving on. There was a press conference, virtual press conference, as all press conferences are these days, a few hours ago. The Nets introducing Steve Nash as their new and surprising head coach. It was a surprise when it broke last week. Somebody you know well from your time with the Phoenix Suns. And I know he also made an appearance on The Jump today, which you were on. There's other Nets stuff I want to talk about, but let's start with the Nash hire real quick. What do you think of, we don't even need to get into like the skipping the line stuff unless you want to, but Steve Nash, well, we could start there, but I also just, and this is the question I put to Nash earlier. He did skip the line, and that's fine. Other guys have done it. Other players have done it. But it does mean that he's never been an assistant, and it does mean that there are things that guys who spent years on a bench know in a way that he doesn't, and he needs to account for or compensate for that. So start anywhere in there. But I do think that there is risk in this for the Nets in the sense that he is coming to this with no bench experience.
I'll say, first of all, he's got experience. It's not as extensive as some people, but he's been on a staff, albeit not full-time, but he's been there. He's worked guys out. He's sat in the film room. He's done the coaching stuff, right? Yeah. That, again, albeit not to the extent of, say, you know, Sam Cassell or someone like that who's been doing it for a long time. So I always cringe when people say, with no experience, he's got more experience than Mark Jackson had and more experience than Doc Rivers had when those guys got their jobs, right? And more experience than Jason Kidd had when he got his job.
Because of his time consulting with the Warriors specifically and some other consulting that he had done with other teams on the side. Yeah.
Right. And also working out players. And also, like, Trae Young works out with Steve Nash. I don't know how many people know that, but Steve Nash coached Trae Young in offseason. Like, he does this. He was involved with Team Canada.
Sure.
He was very close with those young.
Not the same as running a practice or game management timeout calls, all that.
Sure. But again, I say he's got more experience than Doc Rivers, Mark Jackson, and Jason Kidd all had when they got their head coaching call. Fair. Right? So that's one. Two is, obviously, when you're a new coach, it goes without saying. They know it. They don't even need the organization to do it. I'm going to surround myself with experience. I've already got my lead assistant, Jock Vaughn, a guy who's been a head coach in two different locations and cut his teeth in San Antonio and is, you know, a good dude, well-known dude to everyone in the organization, players, management, and Steve as well. So continue to flesh out that roster with people that complement what you do. In the same way that Steve Kerr, when he got the job, he went and got Alvin Gentry, he went and got Ron Adams. He got dudes who have been there before, been around, and he also got young guys who could do, because I think it's increasingly important for every coaching staff to have guys who can get out on the floor and do stuff. And obviously Steve can too, but you need a big guy probably that helps as well. So he's going to do that. To me, the biggest, I won't call it pitfall, but the biggest threat to success would be, does Steve want to do this? Everything that makes him perfect for this job also, to me, is, look, are you going to want to do this after 10-day road trips? Are you going to want to do this when you're home but you're not really home? Steve's a big family guy, right? And he's got young kids in the house. Does he want to keep doing this when, you know, his youngest only sees dad like for an hour a day when he's around, and then days on end when he doesn't see him, like, right? Is he going to want to do this when he's got to deal with all these other kind of small minutiae that aren't necessarily win or lose type of impactful things, but just things that grate and annoy you, right? The day-to-day grind, right? Because Steve is not Tom Thibodeau. My life is basketball. Who am I without basketball? Steve can do anything he wants. This dude is part owner in a soccer club and enjoys filmmaking. He's got interests, dude. He goes skateboarding. He, as I said, devoted dad. He's got the charity soccer tournament that he does every year. He doesn't need to do any of this. Anything he doesn't want to do, right? It reminds me of Steve Kerr when he quit at the Suns. He's like, I'll go do Turner, make more money, and like have my summers back, right? Like that's a very real thing. Now, I'm not here to question Steve Nash's devotion. I'm just saying, when you're someone who has a life, giving this up ain't that hard. It ain't hard in a way that assholes like me, who I've got nothing left, right? I have to do this. I'd love to do something else, but you know, I don't know if I'm capable. I don't know if I'm equipped to do that. Now, having said that, that's the very same reason why I think he's going to be great. Because the two stars he's gotten, you know, Howard, I don't have to remind you, we just talked about it. If the stars ain't happy, fuck everything else, right? So the two stars he's got are guys who think of themselves as bigger than athletes. I'm not just a basketball player. Don't put me in that box. I'm a deep thinker. I'm introspective. I care about the environment and social issues and entrepreneurship and all these things, right? I'm not here to question the validity or the depth of devotion of it. I'm telling you that's what they think of themselves. And so you can't bring in someone who's rah, 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 basketball, basketball, eat, sleep. You got to bring in someone who speaks that language of the world is bigger than this ball. This ball is a vehicle, not the destination, right? Who better than Steve Nash? Who are the candidates that people have named give you Renaissance man like Steve Nash does, right? In a way that those guys not only respect it in terms of you speak my language, but also who are you? A former two-time MVP. Who are you? Right? Like it's not just he's got the attitude and the understanding. He's also got the resume. Look, you can't question my basketball IQ. I did it at 6'2", 180 pounds, and did it twice, right? So from that standpoint, those guys are going to be willing to listen in a way that they may not be willing to listen to other guys, either because their approach isn't quite the right approach, or because they just don't bring the juice that this guy brings.
And this is not to say that Steve Nash doesn't have the basketball acumen, because he obviously has basketball acumen, you know, up to, you know, his eyeballs and beyond. Like, he's as smart about the game as you're going to have. But one of the things I always try to explain to fans or emphasize in these discussions is that the communication, the ability to relate to guys, the ability to make everybody feel part of something, the way that we see Steve Kerr do, the way that we see all the great coaches do. Doc Rivers has that charisma about him. You have to have something. It's more than just the X's and O's. And Steve Nash, I think, will have all that. But it is your playbook, I think, is less important than your ability to connect. And you just hit it on the head. I mean, like, the fact that he is a guy who has that balance, who stresses the importance of all that balance, that will appeal to Durant and Kyrie. I think it will probably appeal to anybody, frankly, but especially to them. And I think that connection, the ability to speak their language, because you only get buy-in if they trust you, and they can trust your credentials, they can trust your MVP awards, everything else, but they also have to trust your judgment and your sales pitch and the way you connect with them. And so, yeah, like I think he fits perfectly with them. I think there's all the reason in the world to believe that this will succeed, even though, as I say, I do, like, it's the risk is baked in and the risk is obvious. He hasn't done it before.
And the other part of this that I would point out is what separates Steve from a lot of other great players is his ability to verbalize and communicate what his brilliance sees, right? What I mean by that is this. Magic Johnson is, without question, one of the smartest, if not the highest basketball IQ in the history of this game, right? Magic saw things that none of us can see. The problem is Magic can't explain what he can see. A lot of people have fun at Magic's expense. They're like, oh, his Twitter account is so obvious, right? Oh, no shit. Like, oh, if LeBron and Anthony Davis do well, the Lakers are going to win. But I submit to you, if everything about this game was obvious, would you be able to discern what is something that is truly instructive and what is just an obvious statement? If everything he saw on TV was super blatant obvious, how do you discern it? How do you know, like, hey, this is a state secret and this is something that a six-year-old watching basketball can figure out? You can't. You can't possibly, right? So Steve has the ability to see something that none of us can see and then help us see it, right? And I'm not saying that kind of vaguely. I'm saying that someone who sat in a film room, having watched the film 8 billion times, and hear this dude say, why don't we just do this? And I'm like, I could have sat here till next year. I would have never thought of that. But he's right. Like, the example I always give is we have this play called Elbow, right? We stole it all from Rick Adelman in Sacramento. You throw it to the big. You have a good passing big. You throw it to him in the elbow, and then you can have your point guard cut away or cut off him or do all these other stuff, right? And what teams are starting to do is they make our big catch it further and further off of the elbow, which messed up the spacing. And so Steve says, why don't we just do this? Next time they try to fight you off the spot, fight them back, but let them win. Just keep coming and then turn it into a pick and roll. And they're so geared up to guard elbow, they're not going to be prepared for a pick and roll. And but it's, like, he just looked at it like, yeah, why don't we just do this? Like, and you look at it, you're like, yeah, that's yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. Why don't we do this, right? And so he's got that ability. And I think that's great when you talk about the younger players, the lesser talented players, the lower IQ players, right? The other guys that fill up the roster weren't Kyrie and KD, to be able to impart that wisdom. And then finally, this dude builds confidence in people like I've never seen before. Hmm. Roger Bell told this story on the radio with us on SiriusXM NBA, where he said, most point guards you play with, they pass you the ball, you fumble the pass, or you miss the layup, or you miss a wide open shot. At best, they give you a stern look. Say, don't fuck up again. At worst, they freeze you out. I ain't passing you the ball anymore. Steve will say, my bad. That's my fault. Should have got it to you better. Should have got it to you earlier. Should have waited. And not only that, he says, you got it.
you'll get the next one. And then the next time down, he'll look for you specifically to put his money where his mouth is. Now, I'm not just saying, oh, you're fine, you're fine. I believe in you so much, I'm going to give you the ball. And so it's no coincidence you saw all these players come to Phoenix and have career years. Yes, part of it is playing with one of the greatest passers of all time. But part of it is he is giving you confidence that you didn't even know you had. And again, when you talk about guys 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 on the roster, that's what they need. All the stuff I was talking about, communicating the KD and Kyrie on their level, that's great for them. It doesn't work well for those guys at the end. But he's got that other part too. And so all of those things, I think the only limitation is his own patience for the bullshit, because the job has a lot of bullshit.
You just keyed in on something that's really, really, really critical, I think, and that is like it's such a hallmark of Steve Nash's personality, which is his humility. And I do think in today's NBA in particular, like having humility in that position is really important, because you do have to defer to some extent to your stars, even in as much as you are leading them and you're creating the framework for them to succeed. You have to know how to navigate that. It's really critical.
By the way,
yeah.
I'll never forget this. I've been working for the Suns for a few months, but you know, as an intern, you keep to yourself. You don't talk to anybody unless they talk to you. You just kind of do your job and get out of the way. And I remember I went to Vegas for All-Star Weekend, and I think GQ threw a party for Steve Nash, you know, because he was coming off his second MVP. They're doing that thing where they slap their name on a party and that's it. It was a very small affair. And so I went. And I saw Steve, and he said, "Amin, I'm glad you could make it." And, you know, this is, again, like, this is, what, 13 years ago? But I still remember that night, and I was like, holy shit. Like, not only does he know who I am, like, my name, not like, oh, the intern made it. He knew who I was, but also he made it a point to make me feel welcome in a space there. It would have been easy and not rude at all. Just say, oh, it's the intern. Oh, wow, what a great night. Like, he came up and he said that. And I've carried that forever. I always say Steve spoiled me in terms of evaluating point guards and really evaluating stars, because he created him and Grant Hill created incredibly high, not barriers, high standards that make me very judgmental. Like, oh, that's how your guy point guard does. Oh, that's how your Hall of Famer treats you all. That's messed up. Because in my world, I was lucky to be around Hall of Famers that were awesome human beings.
Yeah. It actually reminds me, and I don't know Steve that well. Like we've chatted a bunch over the years and everything, but we're not tight by any stretch. We have Mark Stein in common, of course. Steiny very close to yeah. Steve, and I'm buddies with Stein. Same. So Springfield a couple of years ago, when Steve Nash was inducted into the Hall of Fame, and there was he had a party going on downstairs at some bar in Hartford or wherever the hell
yeah.
it was.
The Black Bear.
Yeah.
Black Bear.
So Stein sneaks me into Steve's thing. Like Steve didn't invite me, but Stein's like, don't worry, you're with me. So like I go there, and Steve took time out, like saw me there. We chit chatted, whatever. I told him how amazing the last couple minutes of his speech was and whatever. Like he, again, like I'm one of like, what, I think 400 people or something in that bar. The other thing I'll say too, by the way, speaking of eccentric personalities, you know, Amari Stoudemire and Shawn Marion were not like the easiest guys in the world to deal, like the great players and good guys, but like there were some, you know, peculiarities and issues there at times too with those teams. And you know, Steve always had the ability, as you've pointed out, I mean, to keep everybody happy or to calm the waters when they need to be calmed. So anyway, I think, by the way, everything in his experience prepares him.
When you bring up those guys, Amari in particular, like the growth he had, where he was when he started to where he was when he left Phoenix in 2010, and then what happened beyond. I think a good part of that growth was being around Steve. Of you know, like when you look at the things that Amari became interested in outside of basketball, outside of sports, of the things that he wanted to be involved in, it was from being around Steve and seeing there's more to this game than just this game, right? And it just because you have those interests doesn't mean it's going to take away your attention or your devotion to excellence in what we do.
All right, so we're down to, I'd say probably, let's say 10 or 15 minutes here. I've got burning questions about the Mavericks, the Sixers, and the Thunder. I'm going to do this like game show style. Where on the board do you want to go, Amin El-Hassan?
Let's go Sixers.
Sixers.
That's the biggest, all right. Biggest pile of burning trash, right?
Well, my burning question there starts with the obvious, right? I've got a few, but is it time to consider breaking up Embiid and Simmons, or is it too soon?
No. I think you want to, if you have, first of all, you just gave a long, passionate plea for having two superstars to be able to win in this league. You can't now say, break up, send away one of these all-NBA players.
Like, and I'm not, by the way. I'm just asking.
Yeah, right. especially when you consider, like, you have a new coach coming in. So you've got to give the new coach an opportunity to play with the toys before we figure out, like, yeah, this doesn't work. I will say that it's not a straightforward fit between Embiid and Simmons. You're going to have to be creative with your roster construction. You're going to have to be creative with your rotations. You're going to have to be creative with your X's and O's, whoever the next guy is. Like, it's not straightforward. Oh, yeah, plug and play. Just give them to me. But having said that, again, the goal is to accumulate these types of one in a million talents. They've got two of them. You don't give that up.
I agree. As tempting as I think it is to break them up, you don't do it this soon, especially if you're firing your coach, which they've done now. You have to give the new coach a chance to see if he can unlock something that prior coach, the initial coach, that Brett Brown did not. But also on top of that, yeah, it's really hard to get another star. You do need two stars. You've got two guys who are top 15, top 18, wherever you want to put them. And you cannot take that lightly, nor underestimate how difficult it is to get another one if you decided to give one of them up. So I don't think it's time to do that either. I do wonder what their path is to improvement when they've locked up so much money in Al Horford and Tobias Harris. Two thoughts here. How realistic to trade one of those guys? Can you even hope to pull that off, especially with a cratering salary cap because of all the money lost? Or is that, maybe that is secondary. Maybe, like, there are flaws in this roster, but maybe it simply is about the right coach. So let's start with the coach. Is there one guy you think actually makes the most sense for this group that is going to say, you know what, I can get them over the hump that Brett Brown couldn't, even if we don't find a new home for Al Horford's contract or Tobias Harris?
Yeah, you know, one of the consistent complaints about Brett Brown, and I don't mean consistent just in the last 2 years, but even in the beginning of his tenure, even when they weren't expected to be good at all, was the lack of accountability. I remember a veteran player telling me, you got rookies who are late to the bus and we're holding the bus for rookies. And I said, they're holding the first bus for a rookie? And he said, no, they're holding the second bus. And I said, rookies are riding on the second bus. And if you don't know this, in the NBA, when you're on the road, there are two buses that go to the arena, right? The first bus is rookies, young players, injured players. So they get their work in. And the second bus is the stars, the vets who go there so that, like, by the time they're done warming up, the game is almost about to start. The idea of a rookie riding on the second bus to me was just like, no, they don't. That's not how we do this. But that's how they were doing it in Philadelphia, because they were making concessions for the people with talent, given that there wasn't a whole lot of talent to begin with. And so it makes it hard down the line for Brett Brown to say, all right, enough of the shenanigans. Bro, all we had was shenanigans for 7 years or however many years it was. You can't now become Mr. Tough Guy. You've established the everything. Compare and contrast with Miami. Eric Spoelstra, this is how we do things. Now we got super talent coming in. LeBron, Bosh. LeBron, I don't like this. I don't want to do this. Said, Pat Riley, do you ever get the itch? And the organization is like, nah, there ain't no itches. This is how we do it. You going to do it or you want to leave? And so he did it. When you look around and you realize, oh, no, they're serious about this. Most guys, I always say, like, 5% of players in this league are, no matter where you put me, I'm going to be awesome. My work ethic is going to be great. David West, Grant Hill, et cetera. Those type of guys. Doesn't matter where you put me, I am never going to change. I'm always going to be carrying myself in the highest regard. There's another 5% where it's like, I'm a shitball no matter what. You're always going to have to make sure I woke up on time and be on my ass. And you're going to find me a couple of times for being late to practice or skipping corrective exercise or whatever, right? No matter who I'm around. I'm around a locker room full of Grant Hills, or I'm around, you know, dirt bags. It never changes. The remaining 90%, they just go along with what they see. Everybody else doing this? All right, cool. Right? You might get a guy who tests it
But once he said, oh, no, this is how we do it, then they did fall in line. And so because Brett Brown didn't establish that early, it was hard to then turn the spigot off, right? So you asked me who the next coach who should be. Think someone who's going to come in with a culture of accountability is pretty important. The other part of it is you got to be pretty damn creative offensively. And that's a tough one. Ty Lue, I think, from the accountability standpoint, definitely qualifies. Is he creative enough offensively? I think he can be with a more balanced roster. With this roster, I don't know. It's a tall order, man. I don't know. Who do you have? What names do you think would be a good fit?
It's been suggested to me that this is where Mike D'Antoni would prefer to land. Suggested to me. I'm not saying that anybody's saying this definitively. I don't want this to turn into something. But that if Mike is out in Houston, while Indiana may chase him, and maybe New Orleans too, that Philly is the one that might make most sense. Mike is as creative as they come. I'm not sure I would check the box real strongly on the accountability part, and that's not right. That's not a knock, but Mike is more of a guy who's kind of more of an accommodating personality. I don't think he's going to be the one to suddenly call out Ben Simmons or Joel Embiid
I've worked with Mike. I can say this unequivocally. Mike's approach is, we're all adults. We all know what our job is.
Yeah.
Come up and do your job, right? I'm not going to chase you like a parent or like, an RA in your dorm. Lights out. No, he's not. Mike said, you know what to do. Go do it, right? And so typically Mike thrives with guys who are self-starters and not so much with people who need to be, babysat.
Yeah. So that could be problematic. But on the creativity side, if we're talking about what do you do with this kind of messed up roster and these ill-fitting parts, who can unlock the most? Maybe him, but you're right. On the other side of it, I think Ty Lue would command respect and would. I do think he's the kind of guy who, like, Ty Lue's not afraid of confrontation. Yes. Mike doesn't want confrontation.
Yeah.
Of the rest of the field out there, it's hard because we don't know what Ime Udoka like. Ime, I think, has been a great assistant coach and is a good guy, and he's been around the league a long time and learned from Pop. We don't know. We don't know what Ime is going to be like.
Let me hijack your show right here.
Go for it.
You make a great point. Like, Ime is very well respected, right? But we don't know what kind of coach he'd be, right? That highlights a very important thing. Whenever you hear people on TV or on the internet beating the drum for an assistant coach to be a head coach, unless they work with that person, I don't know how you can say X, Y, Z would be excellent, right? Or you've worked with people who've worked with this person. So I'll give you a great example. David Vanderpool, I've never worked with him, but I've worked with people who work with him, and they all say he is beyond reproach. He is going to be a very good coach in this league. He deserves a chance. Now, I say this based on the opinions of people that I work with, so I know their work ethic. I know how they see the game, and so I trust that, right? These aren't sources. These aren't people I rely on. These are just people I've known for years, right? I know Ime Udoka, again, as a guy that people know and say he's a good dude. I don't know his coaching acumen at all. He might be great. He might not be great. I don't know. And I say all this to say, this brings me back to the Becky Hammon thing. I know having a woman as a head coach would be an immense, immense leap forward, not only for our sport, but for all professional sports. I don't get where people are convincing me that Becky Hammon should be that. How do you know? If you said Nancy Lieberman, I'd be like, okay, I've got a track record where I've seen Nancy Lieberman coach meaningful basketball. Summer League isn't meaningful, ladies and gentlemen. Sorry to break it to you. Meaningful basketball, right? I can buy that, right? I don't know what Becky Hammon is like as a coach. She could be similar to Ime Udoka. She could be great. She could be not great. I don't know. But my point is, neither do you, people on Twitter or media people. And don't get confused between a nice story and something that's real. Now, I know what people would say. Well, me and you just sat here and said Steve Nash. Well, two things. I've been with Steve Nash. I know. I detailed for you guys his accolades and his abilities and his attributes. But the other thing is, Steve Nash is a two-time MVP. There's a privilege at work. Yes, it's called superstar privilege. this game affords privilege. We all have jobs because of these people, because they built this league. Magic and Bird and Michael and Isaiah and all these guys. We owe it to them. LeBron. Yeah. When they retire, they don't have to do the dumb shit that we do of working my way up. And I started in the video room and then I scouted. No, they don't have to do that. That's the thank you we give them. And so that's the difference between a Steve Nash and an Ime Udoka or a David Vanderpool or a Becky Hammond. But I just wanted to get on my soapbox on that, because I always hate when people say, so-and-so should be a coach. How do you know? Where do you know them from?
And I'll just say, without naming names, there have been a couple people that I've known in this league who, based on what I knew of them as players and as assistant coaches, I thought were perfect. I thought they had the basketball acumen, the personality, just the know-how, the communication skills, the ability to talk to both role players and stars, the ability to, like, all of it. I would have checked every box for a couple of guys who I have seen become head coaches in this league and fail badly. So even when we think we know, we don't know. And part of that situational and the jobs that they got, but...
And you're just saying about Steve Kerr, huh? Wow.
No, there are people who check every box that we could think of to check. And then they still have to go do the job. And being an assistant isn't the same thing as being a head coach. Being a really smart, heady role player who connects with everybody and understands the game at a certain level and could be a coach on the court, blah, 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 blah. Sometimes it translates and sometimes it doesn't. Like, we just don't freaking know. So I'm with you. We should not declare that anybody absolutely positively will succeed or that they are owed the opportunity. You know, earned the opportunity, sure. But, you know, no one's owed it when there's only 30 of these jobs and they don't turn over. Well, they turn over a little bit too often. But anyway. All right, moving on. Let's go one more off the board here. Mavs, in which I would probably ask you about the KP Luka. I should say Luka KP. Luka should be first in that. The Luka Porzingis duo and where they go from here. Or on the Thunder, the obvious, especially now that they have parted ways with Billy Donovan. By the way, Billy Donovan, first coach in NBA history to have his contract run out and have it not be framed as him being fired. Instead, it was just, you know, they've all decided to move on. And it's all very amicable. And it looks like a rebuild. And that certainly implies, I would think, being interested in moving Chris Paul, whose value is now much higher than it was a year ago. Chris Paul and the Thunder or Luka Porzingis Mavs?
Let's talk Mavs, man.
All right. Let's talk Mavs. So, first of all, Rick Carlisle, third on my Coach of the Year ballot, because I thought, holy crap, not only does he get these guys through, like, not only does Luka make the leaps he makes as a second-year player in this league in the MVP discussion, and a lot of that's just Luka. But
yeah, about to with say.
Certainly a lot of that is Luka. But still, second-year player who you're entrusting all this to, your number two player is, you know, not available all the time, to say the least, in Porzingis. And the rest of that roster, I mean, the word nondescript, it barely even is enough to define the nondescriptness of the rest of that Mavs roster, which I think Carlisle got absolutely the most out of. But I don't think you can leap from lower tier team to contender, especially in the West, just by squeezing the most out of the, you know, the Tim Hardaway Juniors and the Seth Currys and the you know, everybody else. Where do they go from here? And is Porzingis going to, we don't know his future, but when you have a number two with that kind of health injury or health history, how confident can you be?
Well, I mean, when the number one is as good as Luka, you kind of say to yourself, we'll figure it out somewhere along the lines. They clearly need another playmaker, right? They ran into, I thought, a lot of what Milwaukee runs into, which is a bunch of guys standing around and watching brilliance go to work. And sometimes that works, and sometimes it doesn't work. And so to kind of decentralize the offense and have somebody else who can, independent of Luka, create a shot not only for himself but for others, that would be a priority for me if I were the Dallas front office. The other part about it is when you talk about KP, this is the part that I believe I'm like the only person in America to have said it at the time and to have said it again. The day the Knicks traded Porzingis, right? Obviously, they traded Porzingis because they wanted to clear up the books to go after two max guys. They got all their toxic money off the books. They got two first-round picks and a young player that they really liked in Dennis Smith Jr., right? That in and of itself is a good haul for Porzingis. But the other thing that I was hearing was,
they weren't totally confident on the long-term health of this dude, particularly as he's headed to an offseason where you're going to have to pay him max. So they cashed out when they could because they didn't want to be stuck paying a guy who's going to be hurt all the time. And here we are. Porzingis comes back, and he plays this season, and lo and behold, he has injuries in the exact part of the body that they were worried that he would have injuries in. That, I mean, the Knicks mess up a lot of things. A lot of things. We can do a whole another episode simply on the Knicks screwing up just in the last 6 months. I don't even have to go history in the last 6 months. But that's one where I'm like, even though the Dallas looked great, I thought they did the right thing. Now, what they did with the assets they got as a result, they completely screwed up. But the decision to trade KP in and of itself, I didn't have a problem with it. And that's Dallas's problem now. Now you got a guy who you can't rely on to remain healthy. And that's to be expected when you talk about a 7'3 dude who moves like that.
Yeah, I always thought having somebody who's 7'3 who moves like that and then has the ACL, like, there's just no guarantees beyond that. There weren't guarantees even before the ACL, but once it happens. And so, there was always a risk for the Knicks if they kept him and paid him. There's a risk for the Mavs. And we're seeing that. I don't want to relitigate the trade, but I'll save that for another day. I think I've probably covered it on this pod too many times. But yeah, you know, there was a justification if you wanted to move off of him. I don't think they got the right deal. Again, we don't need to relitigate that today. So he is, as you say now, the Mavs' problem. And they're locked into him for the foreseeable future. You know who their 1-2 is. If they can get a third, like if they're the ones who can snag Bradley Beal or... You know, they'll be in the Giannis sweepstakes, I'm sure, in one, you know, one way or another, if there is a Giannis sweepstakes. I don't actually like the fit there. But they do need another piece. And like a lot of teams in their position, I don't know how easy that will be to maneuver because they don't have necessarily a lot of assets to move at this point, and the cap is what it is. So, you know, if you had to chart a course for them in the offseason, knowing the unreliability of Porzingis' health, is there anybody out there, whether it's free agency, a trade, who would you like to see there that would stabilize this and actually put them in the conversation now with Lakers, Clippers, I don't know who else, Warriors, obviously, Nuggets, that upper tier?
Giannis Antetokounmpo?
For sure. They definitely don't have the assets to get that done.
They're in the sweepstakes. They are in the sweepstakes, right? Like the golden triangle of Toronto, Dallas, Miami. That's what we're talking about, ladies and gentlemen. Those are the horses. And the Golden State, because they're just assholes and they're involved in everything. Who would be a good... You know, it's interesting. I think part of it is they need, like I said, they need a playmaker and they need... Oh, man. You know who would be great? I don't think financially this works, but Fred VanVleet would be great for them.
Yes.
Like that kind of player right there. He's like great shooter, play off of Luka, spacer, but also give me the ball. I'll make something happen. I don't need Luka to make something happen. Trying to think who is a budget version of that who might be available. I think honestly it's something that's going to happen in the trade market because ultimately, again, 2021, they want to be in those sweepstakes. They want to be have that flexibility. So I don't see them signing somebody to a big long-term deal here to fulfill that role if you know they have aspirations of being in the Giannis sweepstakes.
Yeah, it's going to be limiting for them. And that's the thing, like one of the hardest parts about trying to forecast this offseason at all, of course, is we don't know what the numbers are. We don't know how much the cap's going to come down or whether they'll find a way to smooth out the losses and mitigate some of the impact. And we don't know how much room to maneuver any of these teams really truly have. It's going to be a bad offseason for teams trying to really fix things, I think, especially if you're a team that was well over the projected cap, to say nothing of what the actual cap will be. So, like, the question of where do the Mavs go from here? Like, my answer is I have no freaking idea. Like, I think they have time, though, obviously. Like, Luka just finished his second season. Porzingis is still young, and if he can stay healthy, they do have a great 1-2 punch that can carry them for years to come.
And they don't have those pressures, right? They don't have the pressures that Milwaukee has.
Right.
They don't have to do anything. They can literally come back with the same roster and say, oh, everyone's going to be better.
Rick Brunson's kid, whose name escapes me.
Jalen.
I'm getting so. This is how I get. I know I'm getting old.
Yeah.
I call him Rick Brunson's kid, and I call the other one Darrell Wright's little brother. And I just blank every single time on their name. Yeah, Jalen Brunson and
DeLon Wright.
DeLon Wright. There you go. I was gonna call him Darrell Wright again. So, but yeah, they have the luxury of saying we're right on pace, and sometimes that can be an issue. Some would argue that's what happened to Philly. They were on a certain pace, and then they jumped ahead in the pace, and now expectations have arrived, and holy shit, what do we do now? But I think Dallas is on pace, so they don't have to do anything, and they can punt till 2021 before they have to start having serious conversations of markedly improving the roster.
Yeah, agree on all of that. All right, before I let you go, because we're past due here, trade Chris Paul, don't trade Chris Paul?
Trade him. Yeah, this is it. It's perfect. This is what Presti does, by the way. He is the master of extracting the maximum value out of assets, right? He got, I believe, 2 firsts for Harden. He got 6 firsts for Paul George. He got a first for Russell Westbrook.
I think he got 2 firsts and 2 swaps for Russell Westbrook, didn't he?
Oh, two firsts and 2 swaps. That's right. 2 firsts, 2 swaps for Russell Westbrook. And then he's going to turn around and he's going to get some more for Chris Paul. The very first trade he did, I want to say. No, it wasn't the first trade.
The Kurt Thomas deal?
Yeah, the Kurt Thomas deal. He got 2 firsts for to acquire Kurt Thomas.
Back when nobody was doing that.
And then he turned Kurt Thomas around and flipped him to San Antonio and got another first. Got 3 firsts, basically, for just being Kurt Thomas's
Sam's
mailing
wizard.
Address for a few months, right?
Yeah.
He's a master at this. This is the time. Chris Paul is now on everybody's mind as, oh, what a great leader and all the pep in his step, and I think he can play for how many more years, and look at all the winning he did, and da-da-da, and he helped Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, and most importantly, you get rid of Chris Paul before the honeymoon is over, because we all know that day is coming. This is the Chris Paul stage. Stage one is, oh, my God, he's so smart. He's helping me with the game. Oh, he's making me such a better player. Oh, I'm so blessed to have him. Stage two is, man, he's a hell of a mind. He can be a little grating, though, but he helps us win. And stage three is just shut the fuck up. Leave me alone. I don't want to hear from you. I know I messed up. And so to exit at this stage right here, you get him when the value's nice and high. You get some good asset return for him. And you let him leave on a good note. He's like, oh, thank you. I got sent to, a winner or whatever.
And there's only 2 years left in the deal now, so you'll get a better deal now than you would have a year ago when he was coming off of another injury season, and 3 years on the deal now. It's only 2 years. Like, they could not be in a better position, and that's exactly why Sam will make the move, because that's what he does, and because he knows he's never going to be in free agency. They're not going to get stars via free agency, and so he always, takes what he's got, flips when the time is right. He can trade Steven Adams on an expiring. He can trade Dennis Schroeder on an expiring. He's got all the flexibility in the world and 1,000 picks to work with, too.
You know they have a philosophy that they don't let guys get to free agency. The only time they let it happen was Kevin Durant, and they got burnt bad on it.
Yeah, but everybody either gets extended or traded.
Extended or traded. That's why Jeff Green got traded.
That's why
Reggie Jackson got traded. That's why that's why Harden got traded. Either you take the deal, or you're gone, right? And that comes from the pragmatism, I think, of knowing we're in Oklahoma. We can't mess around and just assume guys are going to stay.
Yeah. No, and we're not a destination. So letting guys walk away to quote-unquote clear cap room is almost pointless. I mean, there are other ways to use cap room, of course, but and they have. They've used it to do extensions and all that stuff. But it's not valuable to them in terms of chasing top-tier guys or even second-tier guys. It just isn't. My money would be on them trading him. I'll be very curious to see to where. I think Milwaukee and Philly are both really intriguing prospects. I think the Knicks thing seems strange to me only because it doesn't make sense with where they are. And while he would certainly make everybody that much better with that young group, I also don't know, what other roster could the Thunder possibly be interested in? And this is not a time to start trading the extra picks that you got from Dallas or anything. Just sit tight, Knicks. This is not the time to start swinging for the fences for a Chris Paul trade.
They are already, to me, they're already on the path of self-destruction, right? They're already. You went and got Tom Thibodeau, a guy who is a very win-now coach.
Yes.
I think Tibbs is a very good coach. I know a lot of it's become in vogue to bash Tibbs recently. I'm not on that train. I think he's a great coach. But I also know Tibbs ain't here for daycare. And that's what the Knicks are, right? They're daycare. Daycare because that's who they have on their roster. And daycare because you've got one more year until free agency before you can, you know, jump back in and try and fix all this. So you got that. You got this whole infatuation with all CAA everything, right? Your assistant coaches, your head coach, your major front office hires, your the players that you're linked in rumor to. Like, relax, man. Like, there's life outside of those three letters.
Yeah.
But it's already, you can already see the footprints in the sand before that we've even walked them. This is going to be another era in Nickdom that's just going to nick it up.
put Nick in the dictionary as a verb now. Nick it up. All right. Before I get tempted into a whole Nick's rabbit hole, we should probably wrap and we're over anyway. Amina Hassan, this has been great, my friend. Thanks for taking the time. Appreciate it. Of course, folks, watch him on The Jump. Find him online where he may or may not berate you for bad Patino game picks, but probably will. It's been great, Amin. Thanks, man.
Thanks. I look forward to the next time I'm on in a couple of years.